A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabby Collins. And this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Welcome to Ruthie's Table 4, a production of iHeartRadio and Atomize Studios. I would like to remember exactly when I met Sam Taylor Johnson. Was it at the Tate in 1998 when she was awarded the Turner Prize? Or the day she entered the River Cafe, a beautiful young woman with her first baby, Angelica, in her arms? Was it when she came to see Richard with a book of her astonishing photographs? Were we just invited to a wild and glamorous party in her home that was part of, as Sam says, the blur of what London was in the late 90s? And when was the last time I sat with Sam? Was it in a bar with the love of her life, Aaron, or recently when they missed a flight to Sicily and joined a lunch? And how often have I asked, where is Sam? In London, preparing to direct her Amy Winehouse movie, trekking in Nepal, in the south of France with Elton, or looking for a school in Somerset for her young daughters. The one thing I can always know is that wherever she is, whatever she is creating, Sam is an extraordinary woman. I love her.
Oh. How do I go into that without tears streaming down my cheeks?
We go into it with food. We can start off with a recipe that you chose, which is?
Risotto with porcini and girolles. 1 kilogram of mixed fresh porcini and girolles, cleaned and chopped. Extra virgin olive oil. 1 garlic clove peeled and finely chopped. 1 teaspoon of fresh thyme. 1 liter of chicken stock. 100 grams of unsalted butter. 1 medium red onion finely chopped. 300 grams of risotto rice. 250 milliliters of extra dry vermouth. Now, that's the thing that sends me running around the house when I'm about 10 minutes into cooking it. Just like, do we have vermouth? Do we have vermouth?
Read a recipe twice.
200 grams of Parmesan, freshly grated. I actually cooked this last night. I thought I'd practice just to remind myself what happened about 5 minutes in. Aaron's here.
What happened?
Where
the f*** is the vermouth? Do we have vermouth? I can't make this without the vermouth.
That's so annoying.
Everyone was running around trying to find the vermouth.
But
it's what makes it. In a frying pan, heat 3 tablespoons of olive oil. Add the mushrooms with the chopped garlic and thyme. Season and fry for a couple of minutes until any liquid has evaporated. In a saucepan, heat the butter with the remaining olive oil. Add the chopped onion and cook until the onion is soft. Add the rice and stir. Now, what's so great about this recipe is it's really good if you want to have people around for dinner but not necessarily engage with them the entire time.
Yes. I can't talk to you about the latest movie. I'm stirring a risotto.
I'm stirring a risotto, but it sort of also gives you something to do. So you're active if you're not sure what to talk about. It's sort of a perfectly sociable, unsociable meal to cook. Pour in the vermouth and cook until it's been absorbed, stirring all the while, then adding the hot stock, ladle by ladle. Continue to cook until the rice is al dente. Add the wild mushrooms, the remaining butter, the Parmesan, and the chopped parsley, and mwah, the best risotto ever.
Good. It's comforting risotto.
But this was the first thing I ever cooked from your cookbook, which is why I think it was in one of the earlier ones.
Yeah.
I'm going to be brave and attempt a risotto.
Did you cook when you were a kid? No, not at all.
I didn't grow up in an environment where cooking was celebrated. Food was made to eat, to live. Frozen pizzas, margarine. You know, that was food to put in when you come home from school, make for yourself and eat just to, survive.
So make for yourself. So would you sit down to a family meal or was everybody kind of taking care of themselves?
I almost can't remember family meals. So I think that's, again, why I feel so excited about a kitchen very alive with food being cooked and bread being baked and aromas and activity, because ours was definitely not that environment.
Sometimes I talk to people who grew up with the romantic idea of the family sitting down to a family supper and sitting and talking about the day. And some people described having a mother that worked the night shift, or a mother or father who came home from work and were exhausted, or they came home from work and they would prefer to do homework with you than cook. I mean, there are many reasons why the image of the family meal perhaps is somewhat romanticized, but it is important, something that, as you say, we try and create for our kids. But you didn't have a role model for that, so you had the reverse, but you changed it for your own family.
I did have the reverse, and you know, sometimes, especially doing something like this, you sort of look back and try and find that memory. Now, I definitely remember my mom made a dish that she would be proud of, which was a rabbit dish with mustard, I think, la pain de
moutarde. That's quite sophisticated. Yeah.
But that was something that would come out, I don't know, it would be a big thing. But the rest of the time it was more survival.
What was she doing, or your father doing? Was your father there?
It was my stepfather, really, who my sort of that part of my life is more of a memory.
And so do you think they were doing other things rather than cook, or did they just not?
It's a complicated history, and it's hard to go into, not because it is sort of full of sort of trauma and pain, but it's more that I actually have this sort of almost blackout of, I don't actually have that much memory from that time in my life. And also, if I do go into it or I talk about it, I sort of feel or hope that I've evolved to a place where I don't want to sort of talk about it with malice. It's not that they were working. I think it was more struggle, survival, and mental health, to be honest, and a lot of just difficult scenarios.
Did you have grandparents? Were your parents grandparents?
Yeah, but they died when I was quite young, so I don't really have a memory of them in terms of, you know, I had a great auntie Gladys and a great uncle Les, who I felt very close to, lived in Shepherd's Bush. So there was a lot of time around their house in Shepherd's Bush, and they were very much the sort of meat and two veg.
Were they?
And I remember going home one day and saying to my auntie Gladys, I was like, I can't have roast chicken, I'm a vegetarian. And she said, well, chicken's not really an animal.
It's not really an animal.
Of course you can eat it. I can't. But that was a sort of stability for me. They were the stable hold, the home where I would go to as a student and know that I could be fed.
Did you struggle with food? Did you enjoy it? Did you have school lunch when you were?
I did, but I was a free school dinners kid, so I was in the opposite queue to my friends.
Well, they had different queues.
That's
disgusting.
There was the queue on the left, which was the regular queue.
Out of Dickens, isn't it?
And then there was the free school dinners line, and I wasn't always in the free school dinners line. There were moments where I was in it, and then moments where I could bounce over to the other side. And I just always remember the dread of, oh, today I have to go in the free school dinners line, and that feeling of just like, feeling separate from all your friends, and just that sort of feeling of a little bit of shame that comes with that.
Yeah, a little, or maybe a lot. So you had school lunches and then came home.
School lunches and then home, mostly frozen pizzas.
Where did you grow up?
Firstly, in London until I was 11 in Streatham, and then after that we moved to the countryside, to Sussex. But that was a big shock. I was terrified of trees.
Are you?
It was so funny, because I was such an urban girl until then, and then the idea that I had to walk down these country lanes with trees, it was quite funny.
Interesting, because a lot of the people that I've talked to think about the way they struggled in their youth, whether they were from another country, whether their parents were uncomfortable in being in England, whether they, or in the United States, wherever they were, people who struggled with money, with divorce, and all this is to do, you know, with food and how those memories evolve. And also, I don't know if you feel, but they measure, and I don't know if you do, measure their success by being able to order something delicious on the menu. Paul McCartney being able to order a good glass of wine was something, a way that they measured their their own success. Do you
Absolutely.
Feel that?
Totally. I mean, we never ate out, so eating out really came to me in adult life. And I think that the first time I realized food was for pleasure was actually a college trip to Rome, or post-college, I can't really remember, but we went to a small little restaurant, and I ordered something because I had absolutely no idea what to expect. Tagliatelle with lemon pasta. Mm-hmm. And I remember eating it and just having this sort of total, explosion of flavor and thoughts and feelings about, is this what food can be? Mm. And that feeling of tasting something which just kind of completely opens your mind to potential, I guess, and that it wasn't expensive, it was affordable, and that I could eat this amazing food and not frozen pizzas was a revelation. And probably when I was about 19, I think.
And you went to art school.
Then I went to art school in Hastings, which was like a massive turning point of excitement in my life.
Yeah.
And then after that, into London for art school.
I always think it's another conversation about artists, that creating art is a very solitary activity, that you are in your studio and you paint, and everybody sort of had this kind of wild nights of eating and drinking together because it was so solitary during the day. Did you find that, or was there...
I think art school for me was like a huge door had opened into a world of so much possibility and excitement. And I feel like for the first 2 years when I was at Hastings, I was just sort of wide-eyed and in sort of slight shock that I was in this environment, and just kept very quiet. And then I went to Northeast London Polytechnic, which was a very robust sort of shipbuilding yard feeling, because I was in the sculpture department. And then I left there after the first year and went to Goldsmiths, which by comparison felt like a sort of Swiss finishing school, because people were very elegant and they were talking about ideas. And I felt very like I was sort of sitting on the outside watching and feeling this environment being so alien.
Was that the days of Michael Craig Martin and Damien and Tracy?
It was. And the freeze had just happened, so there was a lot of debate around this huge exhibition that had sort of thrown all these young artists that were still at art school onto the map. And there was a sort of freeze and an anti-freeze. And I just sort of sat again and sort of listened and felt the debates between everything and everyone, but sort of also knew I was in the eye of a storm and eye of a very exciting transitional moment in the art world, because these artists, like Damien, had a studio outside of art school and was already, functioning as an artist and selling and having exhibitions, and Gary Hume and Sarah Lucas, it all was just this sort of bubbling energy that I felt but didn't quite know how to access, because I was still sort of feeling a bit quiet on the outside. It really took going to Tracy Emin and Sarah Lucas, had a little shop in the East End just off of Brick Lane. And it really took going to that little shop to feel that anything was possible, that anything they made was art, and they were artists, and they were allowing themselves to be that. And it was that moment for me that was quite pivotal in understanding I could allow myself to be an artist, that I could actually sort of say it out loud and actually be creative. And I think up until then, you sort of feel like you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, and you're not meant to be there feeling.
Were you as adventurous in your, I guess, development as an artist as maybe in food? Did you go to Chinese restaurants or Indian restaurants? Did you drink whiskeys or
no,
wines?
No, Indian restaurants was absolutely where we all went, because once I became friends with Tracy, we all would, sort of be in that neighborhood, and we'd all, go in and out of all the different Indian restaurants around that area and find our favorites, and that's where we would gather. I felt like exactly how you said earlier about McCartney saying it was a measure of success. I'm growing into my own person because I understand food. I'm growing into my own person because I can take myself to a restaurant and I can actually order something that's completely different to anything I've ever tried before. And I think it is. It's a feeling of, one, you're sort of stepping into being an adult, but also you're stepping into sort of a feeling of new success, not necessarily, you know, huge financial success, but beginning to be able to take yourself places.
The show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Help helps is a maxim I believe in. We all carry around stress and hardship, and when we keep it inside, it starts to chip away. Therapy is a safe place, and therapy is for everyone. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Visit BetterHelp.com/Ruthie today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Ruthie. BetterHelp.com/Ruthie.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabrielle Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? Meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. I sit down with Nicola Coughlan, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then, fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
My first job as a waiter would have been when I was at school. I worked in a local beef eater steakhouse and used to have to wear a beef eater uniform.
Little apron.
Yeah. And then Vic Naylor's in Clerkenwell. Do you remember Vic Naylor's in Clerkenwell? It was a great restaurant. And I mean, it was just fun, but it was also terrible because we all used to get absolutely trashed. And I remember going to a table and someone said, "Do you have any bread?" And I said, "Yes, let me go and get it." And then it was just up the road from St. John. And I said, "Quick, where's the bread?" They're like, "Oh, we don't have any. Can you run to get some from St. John?" Absolutely. I ran to St. John. And then my then manager was sat at the bar. He said, "Come and have a drink with me." So I sat down and had a drink, which turned into two. And I was, "Oh, the bread." Quickly got the bread from St. John and ran back. I was like, "I've got you some bread." It was about an hour ago. This place is terrible. Let me see the manager. Let me go and get him.
He's the manager.
I run down to St. John, pull him out the bar. And the whole story is that he then went up and said, "You asked to see me." "Yes, the service is terrible." He said, "Yes, I agree. Now you should leave."
What year was that?
That was right after I left art school. So 90, maybe.
Yeah, times have changed, I think.
Yeah.
Do you think? Maybe there's still those places, but we've all become much more. Do you know the story about Damien and
which one?
Which one? The one at the Groucho Club where he and Ant got completely trashed. Do you know this?
No.
I banned somebody from the River Cafe for being rude to one of my waiters.
Yeah.
And I was telling the story, I was telling Ant. He said, "Well, Damien and I went, and we got completely, you know, trashed. They closed the doors and we were kicked out and we went on the street. And then we found a ladder and we climbed up and we broke a window. We came in and then we got sick over the pool table. And then we went and got some alcohol out of the fridge and we drank that. Then we, you know, we took something and we crashed out on the sofas." And Marianne, the manager, came in the next day and she said, "You know, I could call the police. You broke and you enter. You damaged my property. and you stole stuff, you know? But instead of calling the police, I am going to ban you for 24 hours. 24 hours.
You know? So brilliant.
Those were the days. I had a customer who just was slightly rude to somebody, and I said he could never come back again. You know, that's the difference.
It is
said.
The measure of a person.
Well, that's why it's good to. Yeah. I think people date people in restaurants, you know. You go on a date and see how they are to the waiter, or you interview lots of people. Have you ever interviewed anybody for a job in a restaurant?
Totally.
Yeah.
You had one this morning.
I had one this
Did
morning
you?
Before I came here. I met with someone to hire for the movie, actually.
Yeah.
Oh, perfect.
Perfect.
Perfect and brilliant.
Oh,
yeah.
Good. And so from being in art school and then being an artist, what was it like once you were all working and I hate to use the word successful, but successful when you and Jay lived in that house and parties. Was food, did you care about food then? Did you think that you all wanted, or was it important to you?
It's hard to sort of cast my mind to that era because it's that thing, I think Coco Chanel said it, it's, you know, I'm six people away from the person I once was, I think.
Yeah.
I sometimes feel like that. And so when I think back to those times, I think of myself as a very different person. And so much sort of shift and change within myself happened during that period. I was suddenly sort of living in this very sort of grand house and living a very different life. And it was all sort of fast rolling and high octane.
Mm.
And fast rolling and high octane is fun. And then it's so hard to maintain. Yeah. And I couldn't maintain it. And I definitely sort of felt like, you know, would throw these parties and then I would disappear off at about 10 o'clock.
I remember.
Do you remember?
Yeah. The part that you didn't talk about, or we haven't talked about in terms of food and being an artist and in that lifetime, was when you were ill.
Yeah.
And the diet that you then, and I remember very well your rigor in dealing with your illness in the way you ate. And I think it was really before a lot of us thought about food and health. Mm. And you were unhealthy and you used food to think about health. And you also took, you know, you went the scientific route. So you went for the medicine and for the but it was an alternative. You did it, but you did do a diet. I remember you very clearly talking to me about no dairy.
Yeah, I mean, I have to sort of almost step outside of myself to talk about it. But yeah, 1997, 6 months after I had Angelica, who's my eldest of four daughters, I got diagnosed with colon cancer. And of course, it was, you know, a shock. But there was such an urgency in my mind to be well and to get back home and be a mother and be present that I just sort of, you know, almost jumped out of the hospital bed and I'm back, I'm fine. And then 3 years later, I got diagnosed with breast cancer. And then I didn't leap out of bed and I didn't say, I'm back, I'm fine. Mm. I sort of quietly retreated into myself, I think. And I went to a very sort of almost a totally different personality to somebody I knew myself as in a way, in order to figure out a way to get through it. And it's a trauma, and in that trauma, you have to sort of figure out, what are my options? What are my options of survival? And obviously, when you're in it, you're not thinking clearly in that way. But, you know, it was very much the first time I didn't take it seriously, almost. Hmm. Second time, I'm going to take this very seriously. Hmm. You know, I want to live. I want to be a mom and be around. And that was my, you know, that was the thing. I had Angelica as my purpose and goal to survive for. You know, it was chemotherapy, mastectomy, and everything medical that I could. But at the same time, I knew that I had to support that for myself with, I had acupuncture. Mm. I gave up drinking and the party life, and I gave up, you know, anything that I felt was detrimental to my health. Sugar, I gave up dairy, and I've pretty much
is that still that. Do you still not have
Yeah. Okay. Let's not be too puritan. Sugar, yes, there's every so often, but it's I'm conscious about eating it. And I'm conscious about if things have, you know, I'm very strict about milk, very strict about cheese. Butter, I'll allow it. Then, you know, and I'm not going to be too, because there's also a point where you just have to, you know, you have to function in the world. And you know, there was probably at least 5 years where I was absolutely, I would read every ingredient and nothing could be, because I was frightened, you know, and fear is a very good reason to make sacrifices and changes in your life. I just shifted into a completely different person in a way.
Would you tell somebody who came to see you that if they had cancer in any form, would you say to them to try this, to do this
diet? It's hard because you don't, it's difficult because also, you know, there's varying, you know, your case is different to the next person's, the next person, to what level you have it, or, you know, it's hard to advise people in that way.
We talked about,
but I tend to people who are in it. I try to be, you know, get up in the morning, put on a great song, move around, call people when you're feeling down. I try to sort of keep it, you know, let's keep it in a place where we're going to get through this. It's a job. It's a job. And, you know, it's also, you can't, people say, well, you're so brave to have gotten through it. But it's not bravery that gets you through it, because it doesn't mean that people who haven't survived aren't brave. Getting through it is, you know, an amount of medical intervention, amount of luck in terms of diagnosis, and what you can then do to support all of that.
Yeah, but when you talk about the energy or the, you know, the getting up and doing, that has shown that actually that kind of activity with any illness, with grief, you know, I say that having been through grief in my life, that I sort of know the drill, you know, which is you get out of bed or I mean, you can stay in bed and cry all day too, that's fine. But the, from, you know, the activity and that.
It is, and the support of, you know, friendships. Yeah. When I would have chemo, I'd have like Gary Hume and Georgie and Johnny Shankid, and friends would, you know, they'd bring food and sit around and sort of laugh and sit with me for a few hours.
Yeah.
And, you know, you'd sort of feel, you know, the chemo going through your veins. But on the other hand, you could be eating some strawberries and chatting with friends and watching everyone just, you know, support you in that way. Yeah. And I think, and that's also, you know, that was definitely sort of food related in the sense that, you know, chemo can taste bad in your mouth. It's sort of metallic-y.
Yeah.
And my friends had researched that a little bit. And I've heard if you have, you know, some boiled sweets, or if you have this, or, and then another friend, mango's really good.
Rose ate mango.
Yeah.
That's interesting to say that, because Rose Gray, who we started the River Cafe with, and had breast cancer, just found that she, I mean, I always say that she ate her way through chemo, you know, she just ate everything, but she was careful and as she was before she got sick, but she loved having mangoes.
Serotonin, I think it's good for. But so I think it's also, I mean, still now, really, education around nutrition and what's, you know, what's good for you to live, like I said, as a keep the machine at optimum level.
Definitely.
You know, and maintenance. We maintain our cars sometimes better than our bodies, I think.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabrielle Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? Meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. I sit down with Nicola Coughlan, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then, fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout, and woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, my name is Hamish. I am one of the chefs here at the River Cafe. One of the sauces or dishes that I think is very special to us and is coming back onto the menu a bit more often is our banya cauda. We make this sauce by reducing down a bottle of Italian red wine or champagne or Prosecco, and then we melt in about 12 to 15 cloves of garlic, anchovies, and this creates a really intense, salty, amazing base to a sauce. Then copious amounts of butter to make it extremely smooth, silky, and just rich and delicious.
That is my favourite.
Anchovy and butter.
Anchovies on sourdough bread.
It's the saltiness of the anchovy too, isn't the butter?
But I think growing up, what it equates to, see, that would be my, I'm successful and knowledgeable and I can eat anchovies on toast. It comes from growing up with Marmite on toast.
Oh, yes.
It's one of those. And Marmite on toast for me has been a constant from childhood all the way through my student life, artist life.
So I was talking about the solitariness of being an artist, but what about as I go back to the cinema, when you directed Nowhere Boy or when you directed 50 Shades of Grey, do you think about how you feed the people on the set? Is that important to you, the way you stop for a food break? Wes Anderson said he hates a lunch hour because it makes everybody stop and then you have to get tired and then you, but you know, he tried to give everybody soup, but then the crew wanted meals. How do you deal with
Being on a set? I feel absolutely with Wes in that way, that I don't like when everyone stops for lunch, but at the same time, I do like the communal break of everyone sitting and sort of literally digesting what we've done and talking around food. And I always try to make sure we have reasonably good caterers so that everyone's just sort of enjoying that time rather than just complaining, ugh, this is disgusting.
Was there a difference in doing Nowhere Boy and 50 Shades of Grey from...
I'm sure there was. I can't remember. 50 Shades had its own trauma. But but Aaron and I made a movie in 21 days. We made a million little pieces and it was the smallest budget, but we had the best food.
Does the food culture feel very different from Los Angeles? Moved from LA to the English countryside. What about food? Does that feel different?
It's a radical shift, not in our house because we cook the same things, but definitely a different culture of...
Well, the difference is avocados, there's certain things that grow differently. So,
avocados.
You know, when you're,
that's
we were West
we
Coast, so
of.
If you had these sort of, anything Californian or from Mexico, the avocados are different. So guacamole is like amazing. Avocados here, they're sort of imported from Spain and they're hard and they're there's just no point. There's no point in avocado on toast. Eat that over here.
I really respect that you said that, Aaron, because it is to do with the ingredient.
Absolutely.
You know? What about, do you go to fewer restaurants here? Did you eat out more in LA?
We did, probably, I think. But we are in the middle of
but
nowhere.
But it was more urban there, too, probably.
Yeah, and there was a different routine, I think, there for food. I was really into, and I'll have a shake, and could you put some reishi mushroom and a little bit of this and a little bit of that? And there, everyone seems so knowledgeable about what, what each ingredient of this certain mushroom is going to give you. You know, this one's for the brain and cognitive function, and this one's for memory, and this one's for your liver, and this one's for, No. So I was getting quite good at all of that and understanding how it was going to benefit me. And then, you know, I got here and I was like, where am I going to get my chargar?
Yeah. Do you drink coffee? Do either of you drink coffee?
I do.
I'm new to coffee.
Yeah. We're very new to coffee. But like the American coffee was just the sort of the diner coffee.
Just the all-day, full-on filtered coffee
where it was just sort of,
Tell me about food in your house. How many children are
four? So I mean, four. We have four this weekend.
Yeah.
They're all four at home. I mean, my speciality is the pancakes. I'd like to say I'm the pancakes person.
Puttanesca.
I have my dishes, but the pancakes, so in the mornings I can make crepes, I can make big fluffy pancakes, as they're called, or I can do the green pancakes, which are, Romy, my youngest one, absolutely loves. She's very
What are the green, what is that, how are they made?
They're basically one egg, one banana, gluten-free flour, a handful of spinach, and cinnamon and vanilla.
Yeah.
And a cup of almond milk, and blitzed, and then fried in coconut oil, and they puff up, and they're absolutely
they
delicious.
They puff up, do they?
They puff up with a little bit of baking powder in there, and then with syrup
on top.
Yeah, Aaron's good at cooking. Literally, sort of, it's
are
like
seven, eight
dishes are on the table when he cooks. I'm just like,
that's so nice.
But I can't bake.
Yeah. When Aaron ever goes into the kitchen to bake, we all are literally waiting for a blood splattering across the wall. Because you're always
I once took it off with the blender, didn't I?
With the cherry pie.
What was the blender thing that you press?
Oh, yeah, the hand blender. Oh, yeah, he put his finger in it.
Yikes. Well, I was trying to take what was left over dough off around the things with my finger, but my hand was obviously gripping the top of the button, so it went and blitzed the top of my doesn't have much of a nail on that one. Took my finger off.
Yeah. So what do you do for desserts? Do you have desserts,
just
or do you just don't
it.
Have them?
You and Romy. Romy, our youngest, is a bit of a baker actually. Yeah. So we recently got
apple
a really beautiful
crumble.
Yeah, a gorgeous apple orchard in Somerset. And with a mixture of cooking apples and cider apples and good eaters.
And blackberries everywhere now.
At the moment, there's tons of blackberries. So recently it was a blackberry and an apple crumble.
My last questions to you, Aaron, and to you, Sam, would be, if you need food for comfort, is there a food that you would reach for?
Marmite in a jacket potato is probably actually could trump the anchovy on toast. But Marmite, butter, jacket potato, that is my comfort food. Okay. I know, I'm looking at you.
No, that's fine. Thank you.
You will be.
You're my comfort. Oh, my love. Thank you, Sam. Thank you, Anne.
This was a joy. Thank you so much.
The River Cafe Lookbook is on sale. 100 pages of beautiful photographs that will inspire you to cook. It's a lookbook. It's a cookbook. Order one now. Ruthie's Table 4 is a production of iHeartRadio and Atomize Studios. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's Better, H-E-L-P.com.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabby Collins. And this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Watch season 3 of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s,
she looked like a million bucks,
scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes.
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old Richmond because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast, and I had the opportunity to talk to one of Hollywood's major icons, Michael B. Jordan. In our conversation, Michael shares the highs, the lows, and everything in between, offering a genuine glimpse into his world.
The closest to getting what you want is always the hardest. People give up right before they get what they've always wanted to get.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.